some of this be? No, I think I'm good. Where am I going to put this? Not here. Oh. Okay, play three. Oh, this is being out. Okay. Welcome to the talk called The Freedom Network, A Technical Perspective, or so it says on the little blurb outside. There was this other much longer title that was given on the little Zero Knowledge flyer that advertised the party, but I don't like that long title. So I'm Ian Goldberg. I'm the chief scientist for Zero Knowledge Systems, which is this company out of Montreal that makes software that does what I'm going to tell you about. And this is the Ottawa Linux Symposium, and this is a green laser. Okay. First, I'm going to motivate what the Freedom Network is, and then I'll tell you what it is, and then I'll tell you how we build it. The general idea is that I have a limited number of slides. As I said, the slides are all of 5 minutes old. So I encourage questions. Okay, questions and talking and whiteboard writing are what I'm much better at. You'll get little to no marketing out of me. I'm not a marketer. I don't like marketing. You'll get tech. Okay, you can ask arbitrarily technical questions, and you'll get arbitrarily technical answers. Okay, so first we're going to motivate the problem. The old problem, which is basically solved now, is how to hide the contents of a communication from an adversary. Right? If Alice is talking to Bob, Alice wants to be able to send a message to Bob in such a way that Eve, the eavesdropper, can't read it. And there are other related problems such that you want to allow Bob to make sure that it was in fact Alice that wrote the message and not a malicious Mitch in the middle inserting random data and things like this. We know how to solve these problems. Cryptography is your friend. Right? And here in Canada, cryptography really is your friend. So this isn't the problem we're trying to solve. Cryptography is still a useful tool in order to solve the problem we're actually trying to do, but whereas this is the main region where cryptography is useful, this isn't the problem we're doing. What's our problem? Our problem is hiding the existence of a communication from an adversary, not the contents. So if person A is talking to person B, we want the adversary to be unable to even determine the fact that person A is talking to person B. Right? Why might this be interesting? I've listed some simple scenarios here. If the CEO of one big company starts sending emails to the CEO of another big company, I know a lot of day traders who might be interested in that bit of information. Whistleblowers, dissidents, these are common uses for anonymous technologies. You want to be able to point out that your company is doing something evil to the environment without being smushed. And you want to be able to criticize your government without being killed. A third thing I've put here, because it's related to another research topic of mine, anonymous eCash. We have these great protocols for anonymous eCash that we could basically put together today and deploy, and it would be all great, if only it weren't for the fact that you can't actually use it on the internet, because as soon as you make a net connection to the store, they know who you are, right? It doesn't matter that they don't know your bank account number directly from the eCash. If they can get your TCP address or IP address from the TCP connection and just work out who you are that way. So having a way to communicate anonymously or pseudonymously is a necessary part of doing a good anonymous eCash system. Okay, so what's the goal going to be? We're going to build a pseudonymous IP or pipe network, which, this is the only bit of marketing, will be called the Freedom Network when it's implemented by zero-knowledge systems. Okay, that's it for the marketing. Why?
Marketers don't use the word freedom.
Well, they do, and it's the name of the product. Okay, why do we want a pseudonymous IP network in particular? I talked earlier, I mentioned the word anonymous a couple of times. It's important to realize the distinction between anonymity and pseudonymity. And there, in fact, it's not just 2 points. There's this whole thing we call the nimity slider, which goes at one end from complete anonymity. On the other end, you have true name. And there are all sorts of things in the middle. There's out here, there are things like linkable anonymity, persistent pseudonymity, and so on. I can give a brief outline on what these things are. True name is pretty intuitive what that means. It's not entirely clear. What is your true name? I'm not saying it's the name that appears on your birth certificate that the government gave you. It's just any kind of identifier that can pick you out of a crowd. Right? So whether that be your IP address, your email address, or some other identifier, your credit card number, something like this. It's just some way that you can be distinguished from any of a large number of other people that might have done that transaction. All the way over here, we have complete anonymity. This is where you do a transaction, like you walk into a store, you buy something with cash, and you walk out. Okay? The difference between complete anonymity and linkable anonymity is that when you go into the store the next time and you buy something with cash again, the question is, can that transaction be tied to your previous transaction? That is, even though the shopkeeper doesn't know who you are, does he know that it was the same person that participated in those two transactions? Right? In complete anonymity, the answer is no. In linkable anonymity, the answer is yes. So an example for linkable anonymity, I don't know if you've got these things around here. I assume you do. Things like frequent purchaser cards, points, air miles cards, things like this. You walk into the liquor store, you buy your case of beer, you give them your air miles card. They don't necessarily know who you are. I don't know how air miles works, if they're actually tied to a person or not. But certainly,
Coke card is a better example.
Coke card? Okay. So there exist points cards like this, the Coke card, where it's not tied to you in any way, but the same card, if you use it over and over again, they can tie your purchases together. So that's this part of the scale. Persistent pseudonymity, it turns out, is one of the most useful places to be on this slider. The reason is you can build what's called reputation capital. And that allows people to gain reputation with the merchant so that they can get deals, they can become a well-known customer who's known not to defraud the merchant, and so on. In the online world, you have things like when someone posts to the net under an email address you don't recognize using the name John Smith, you have no idea if their name is actually John Smith, nor should you care. The point being, if the same person posts over and over again, and you either tend to agree with what this person says a lot, or you tend to vehemently disagree with what this person says a lot, they will gain positive or negative reputation with you. And one important part of pseudonymity is that people can't forge it. Someone else can't post under the pseudonym John Smith if they're not the same person who posted earlier, because that would ruin the reputation system. The other important part of persistent pseudonymity is that you can have more than one of them. So whereas with true name, you're limited to one true name, basically. And if somehow that name gets besmirched or spoiled due to malice or a mistake. We see this often with credit card companies, for example, and credit reports. Sometimes people by mistake get a black mark on their credit report, and it's just impossible to get that thing off. It's so much pain. And the problem is you can't just say, okay, erase that one and start a new one. I don't want to worry about this credit report. You can't start a new name. So the useful bit of persistent pseudonymity is that you can have more than one name that you can use to separate out various aspects of your life. An example we use a lot is when you're browsing the web and searching for a job, that should not necessarily be linkable to the times when you're browsing the web searching for a date. Right? Depends what your job is. Okay. So the point of this network is going to be to allow the use of the internet without revealing true names or other things up there on true name like IP or email addresses. Moving on. Okay, the high level view from 10,000 feet, we're going to build an anonymous IP infrastructure. Okay, note anonymous here, but pseudonymous down here. I'll get to that distinction in a moment. The idea is we're going to deploy a number of proxies around the internet called anonymous internet proxies, or APIs. That wasn't bad. IP packets sent by clients. The client will take any IP packets it's about to send on the network, and instead of just sticking them into the internet to be magically IP routed, best effort to wherever they belong, instead, he sends them to a chain of these apes. So he sends them to some ape, we'll send it to some other ape, we'll send it to some other ape, and finally it'll be sent to its intended destination. The point, the goal, is that we'd have to compromise all apes in a chain in order to break the anonymity of the system. So if an adversary wanted to figure out who this person was that was talking to www.playboy.com, they'd have to do quite a bit of work in breaking, in compromising either technically or more to the point legally using a subpoena or something like this, all the apes in the chain. I'll talk more about this in just a bit. And then what we're going to do with this anonymous IP infrastructure is layer on top of it a pseudonymous IP network. The reasons for this are a little bit philosophical. They have to do with the fact that if you look at the NIMTY slider, if you have a system which gives you, say, complete anonymity, like cache, it's really easy to build on top of that a system which gives you anything higher than that on the NIMTY slider, right? You're always free to exchange identicards with the merchant when you go in and pay with cash. On the other hand, if you have a system which requires something high on the NIMTY slider, such as credit cards, right? If that's your only means of payment, and today that pretty much is your only means of payment if you want to do something online, if you want to pay for something online. If the only way you have to pay for something is credit cards, it's really hard to remove the identity information from the system. So the goal is going to be to build a system that is as low on the NIMTY slider as possible. And once that infrastructure is in place, then we can easily stick the slider anywhere above that we want, that we feel is useful for social reasons or anything else. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to build an infrastructure that allows for anonymous IP traffic, and then just layer on top of that the ability to do persistent pseudonymity and thus get reputation capital and things like this. Okay, how do we build an anonymous IP infrastructure? The primary interesting piece, which is the only one I'll talk about in this talk, is called the IP wormhole. And I'll describe what that is in the next slide. There are some other pieces, the network information database, which keeps track of what apes are up and down, application level proxies are used for stripping information from the headers of the application that might identify you, and so on. Okay, so here we're coming to not why we're building it, but what in fact we're building. And then we'll talk about how we build it. Okay, so the IP wormhole, it's an internet service. It's this magic thing running out there somewhere on the internet for the purposes of this medium level view now. And the idea is that a client anywhere on the internet can take their IP packets and inject them into the IP wormhole. And just like the Star Trek wormholes, you can, although a little cooler than the Star Trek wormholes, you can say where you want the other end to be. Right? So I can say, I want to stick my packets in on my local computer, so they never go out over the net at all. And I want them to appear again, let's say in South Africa. Right? So you can choose somewhere on the net where you want your packets to just magically appear. At that point, of course, they'll be IP routed in the normal way to their intended destination. But the source address on that packet will look like it's in some machine in South Africa. Okay, and that is pretty straightforward. A little bit trickier is how do you allow packets to get back? So when the server replies to that packet, you do want it to get back to you and not go, well, it will go to South Africa, certainly, because that's where the IP address is, but somehow you want that packet to get back to you and not to, for example, someone else who's using the system. Okay, so in the next few slides, I'm going to show some not-so-good attempts at building an IP wormhole, sort of to motivate why this is a hard problem. Okay, so the easiest thing you could possibly do is just turn on IP and IP tunneling on a number of hosts around the internet. Right? Linux comes with this. You can just turn on IP tunneling by loading a module and setting some things. And that would, if you just turn that on promiscuously, you basically allow any host on the internet to send a packet to any other host on the internet via you. Right? Well, that would seem to kind of solve our problem. We just stick one of these somewhere well connected at one of the NAPs, and we just say, yeah, just go via us. All your IP packets will just take them, strip off the outer layer of encapsulation, and send them on. And this is basically, if you think about it, what services like the Anonymizer do for web traffic. Right? They just say, we're the central service. You connect to us as a proxy, and we'll just forward your request off to the final web host. So that's basically just what mobile IP, in fact, is doing. The true client can be anywhere, but it will always appear to have the IP address of his home base in the mobile IP world or this single proxy you're going through in the IP tunneling world. So the anonymous internet proxies, we allow clients to select from a number of bases. So we don't have one central server. We have a number of these around the world. So what's the problem here? These arrows are going to indicate the problems with these wormholes. Anyone who can read the packets coming into the apes can easily identify the client. Right? So let's think about the threat model. What is the threat model we're going for? We want to provide strong resistance to attack. Right? We don't want just any random elite hacker dude with access to a packet sniffer to be able to subvert the system and tell who is doing what on the net when they're supposed to be anonymous or pseudonymous. So in this kind of system where I've used no encryption or anything like that, you can easily just read the packets off the net and figure out who's doing what. So what's the solution? You add encryption. Okay, so this is straightforward. I'll go through these pretty quickly because they're less interesting than what comes after. So attempt two, we're just going to add encryption. The attacker can still see the encrypted packets arriving at the ape and the corresponding decrypted packets leaving it. So you'd think, okay, well, that's pretty good. Remember that there are lots of people using this ape at once. So there are lots of packets arriving from lots of different clients and lots of packets leaving for lots of different servers. The attacker's goal is to figure out which client is talking to which server. Right? And before, whereas he could just look and see, well, he sent this content with an extra header, and then that content went out here. So that was a trivial comparison. Now it's encrypted. What do you do? So it's pretty simple still by using size correlations. So you have a big packet comes in and a big packet goes out. A little packet comes in and a little packet goes out. And it's pretty easy to quickly tell who's talking to who. Okay, how do we fix that? We add packet padding. We pad each packet to a fixed length or one of a number of fixed lengths. Now the attacker just sees packets of a fixed size coming into the ape and packets of the real size going out, so he can't use the size correlation anymore. Great, so we foiled that problem. Well, turns out that helped us very little. The attacker can now just use some other meta information like the time the packet came in. Right, he'll see a packet come in from some client, and very shortly thereafter, a packet will leave for some server. And if he correlates those comings and goings of the packets, he can. It doesn't take much data to deduce which client are talking to which server. Okay, now what? So now we do some more interesting things, and this is this actually has some meat behind it, so we won't see the meat for another 3 or 4 slides. So we add link padding. And what link padding is not only are the packets all the same size, but we send the same number of them per unit time. Right? So we send packets at a constant rate, whether we need it or not. Okay, so that means that your data is sort of smooshed out, and if there's no data to send, we just send random things that hopefully the attacker cannot distinguish from encrypted things. So now the attacker just sees a constant stream of constant size packets going from the client to the ape, and data going out of the ape at arbitrary sizes and times. And this does solve the passive eavesdropper problem. Okay, but then there's another problem. The operator of the ape still knows which clients are communicating with which servers. Right? So if that ape is compromised, either, as I said, technically if someone breaks into the machine, or politically if someone serves the operator with a subpoena, then that's a single point of failure for the system. Okay. How many of you are familiar with... Yeah?
Comment. If someone starts to make a connection to a specific site that you weren't communicating with before, you can still know if they're there, so it actually doesn't... solve the eavesdropper problem if you have the history behind it. You have 1,000 people talking to 1,000 clients. 1,001 comes in, starts to talk to a new.
Right. So what you have to do, is connect to the ape before you're going to actually start connecting to servers. So you join the cloud, as we call it. Huh. Right. So you start sending data to the ape, but it's all bogus data. Right. And only later do you start a connection out.
I have a question related to that, too. With the random padding of data, which is sent when, say, the client are not sending real data, is that solely in between the different apes? Or, for example, does an ape generate random traffic and say, send it 3 apes down the chain, and then that one says, oh, well, that's just random garbage.
Okay, so you could do that as well. And... depending on your threat model, that's either useful or not. In the threat model I've talked about so far, in which you have a passive eavesdropper, turns out it's not useful to do that as well. In other threat models, where different numbers of apes might be compromised, it turns out that is useful. There was a question in the back.
With the random generation of packets, is that just between the client and the ape, or is the ape also sending random information just out to the internet as a whole?
Not out to the internet, but between apes.
Between apes, okay.
Right. So sending it out to the internet is a much harder problem that it's unclear can even be solved properly. Basically, what you're asking for, and it would be nice to do, is to have random traffic that looks like normal user traffic.
Right.
Right? And that's a pretty hard problem to solve. I would suggest a few other sites that might be more popular. Okay, how many of you are familiar with the concept of anonymous remailers for email? A whole bunch, okay. The idea is basically the client just takes his email message and instead of sending it to the destination, he sends it to a number of servers in between. And that's the same thing we're going to do here for packets. And the simplest thing is just, well, we take attempt 4, which was just the last thing we did using the encryption and the link padding with one guy in the middle, and we just tell the first guy that his destination is the second guy, and we tell him that his destination is the third guy. So you just have a bunch of these encrypted secure connections between APE1 and APE2, APE2 and APE3, and APEN and the final server. It turns out this isn't quite right. And the reason is the IP packet basically is in the clear here. It gets encrypted on the link. APE1 decrypts it. It's in the clear. And then it's encrypted again, and it's decrypted in the clear. And the problem there is that compromising just the first and the last apes suffices to defeat the chaining, regardless of the number of hops in between. And compromising any one ape in the chain will reveal the data in the packet. Right? So that's to be avoided. Okay, so this is what's actually going to work. Instead of just having secure links between 1 and 2 and 2 and 3 and 3 and 4, you also add more secure links, one between the client and 1, the client and 2, the client and 3, until the client and N. We would, in the best possible world, we would also add then between the client and the final server. But that requires application support at the server side, and we're assuming we want to be able to use this with all web servers and whatever other IP services out there on the net, and we're not going to require everybody to add secure code, although it would be nice. What can you do? So we're going to have to live with the fact that the data between the last ape and the final web server, say, is going to be in the clear. Okay, here we go. Technical details. Okay, so now we have an hour to talk about the remaining, like, 3 slides. So this is where I'm going to draw on the whiteboard a lot and answer lots of questions that you're going to ask. Okay, so there are 3 main interesting parts to the IP wormhole. So I've described the IP wormhole as an internet service that allows you to drop IP packets in and have them come out in an arbitrary place on the net. So you might expect it's not quite arbitrary. There has to be an ape there. But assuming we deploy apes all over the place, you can have it come out at any one of the apes. And allows for the replies to come back. So the 3 interesting parts. So if we draw the internet, or at least the anonymous wormhole part, the 3 main interesting parts are how you get packets in, how you get packets through, and how you get packets out. Okay? So first we'll talk about how you get packets through. So the most interesting bit here, other than the apes themselves, which do all the encryption and decryption and signing and routing and all these things, those are fairly straightforward. It's just a user-level process under Linux. These servers here are running Linux. We'll assume the client is also running Linux there, just because this is a Linux conference. And I can talk with much more sense about the internals of the Linux client than I can the internals of the Windows client, because I know nothing. Okay. So, yeah, within the wormhole, all we're doing is sending UDP packets around. So your IP packet is basically multiply encrypted and encapsulated in a UDP packet that's just sent from one user-level process to another. So there's not much meat in that part. The interesting bit is called the traffic shapers, how we do this link padding that gets from one ape in the network to another, sending it. They're making faces at me. How we send it at a fixed rate of fixed sizes. So the apes are construct the encrypted packets and then pass them via a pipe system call to, or a pipe set up by a pipe system call, to one of a number of separate processes called traffic shapers. These traffic shapers are currently, although this hopefully will change at some point, they're user-level processes whose job it is to send these fixed-size UDP packets to a fixed destination host and port at a fixed, technically it's not fixed, it's just data independent. And I can explain the technical difference if you're interested, at a fixed rate. And as I said before, if not enough packets are available when one is supposed to be sent, the traffic shaper will just send a random packet that hopefully is indistinguishable to an attacker from an encrypted packet. That's the way cryptography is supposed to work. Okay, so now I'll go over to the whiteboard. And
are you going to be sending it full speed at all times?
No. So that's the difference here, the difference between data independent and fixed. Data independent just means the shape of the traffic you send is independent of the shape of the traffic coming in. So you can send, for example, so you can send modulated traffic based on other things, such as the time of the day, the network congestion, what kind of bandwidth is available on your network. It just can't depend on how much data you actually have to send. Okay, which seems a little strange, but if you think about it, that's enough for to get the proofs of security you want. Okay, so what happens inside this traffic shaper? So we have one user-level process which generates a packet. UDP. Well, not really. That's encrypted. Encrypted IP. That is sent over a pipe, as I mentioned, to another process which sticks it to first approximation, it just sticks it in a queue. Where's the pipe? Right. This process is also has a timer. And this timer goes off once in a while. And at configurable times, this timer goes off, and this process wakes up and says, oh, it's time to send K packets from the queue, where the frequency of the timer and the value of K determines how fast you're flooding your link, and that is what will vary over time, but in a data-independent way. Right? So this process actually, over this link, can send not only packets, but also metadata, like commands to say, okay, now turn up your volume, turn down your volume, and things like this. And it's implemented exactly how you would expect. I'm not going to bore you with code like that. That is just, I assume everyone here can code in C and do simple net level things. So it just gets stuck in this queue. And then once in a while, this guy wakes up and looks for the first K elements in the queue. If the queue only has fewer than K elements, then it will fill it up with random packets before sending them. And then this guy will actually send the data out to the internet, where it will arrive at the fixed destination host, which is another E.
Does doesn't that play havoc with a lot of the TCP RTT estimations and things like that?
Okay.
Because it's trying to figure out what your bandwidth should be.
Oh, it so does. Yeah. So the it turns out it's not as much as you might think, because the individual packets, they're being delayed by some jitter, basically. And TCP has this, it's the right way around this time. TCP has this annoying habit that it assumes that all packet loss is due to congestion and not due to a lossy link, which is really annoying when you're on a radio link or something like that, where your congestion is, in fact, your packet loss is, in fact, due to loss. But in fact, here, it's exactly what TCP is expecting. TCP knows that when you send data, it might be delayed because of congestion in a router. So it already takes that into account when you do the it's calculating its round trip time. So we're messing it up a little bit by adding a little bit of jitter, but it turns out since it expects some amount of delay anyway, it's not too bad. Any other questions so far? Yeah?
How would this system perform in a voice over IP situation?
Huh.
If you're introducing jitter and you're introducing processing delays for encryption and decryption of each tape, that's going to throw it off.
Okay, so it turns out the latency you add through the system in normal to good cases should be much smaller than the latency of, say, a 28.8 modem. Right? Those latencies are huge. They're like half a second for a round trip time. So it turns out we don't add much more latency than that. I can't imagine how you can even do voice over IP over a 28 modem now that I think about it. It just, you have to have half a second of latency, and your ear can tell a tenth of a second. So, yeah.
So the whole system does add latency.
Oh, it does add latency.
Yeah,
so the question is, I guess, does it add a tenth of a second latency? I guess we'll know when we deploy it more. I would like to be able to do voice over IP, of course. Certainly, you could do it in one direction, right? Because it adds, although it adds jitter, voice algorithms can easily compensate for that by buffering. And so you'll get a clean speech out the other end. It'll just be delayed. Right, so that's pretty acceptable. That's basically what most voice multicast systems do today, like the VAT and RAT stuff. So I'm confident that one direction will work. So broadcasting stuff will work fine. Having a conversation will be annoying. But
geostationary satellites are
also as annoying. Yeah, so people who do really long distance calls a lot using satellites are used to this effect. So although we'd love to get it as low latency as we can, I'm skeptical we'll certainly get it below the modem barrier, because there will be one anyway. But that is definitely a useful application for this kind of system. Right? You can have pseudonymous telephone numbers all of a sudden. That's pretty neat. There another question? Yeah.
Yeah, you're doing a bunch of stuff they don't, but a large chunk of this looks an awful lot like the crowds.
The crowd stuff. Okay.
The AT&T guys were talking.
Okay, so I wasn't expecting you to compare to that. So I have a slide comparing it to IPsec, which it looks a lot like. But okay, I'll just quickly throw one together comparing it to crowds. So crowds, actually, that line is very similar to this one. I'll just bring up that last slide because it's good to look at probably at this point. And in fact, you could write the same first line for crowds. Crowds is a solution to a different problem. Okay? And who's familiar with the crowd system? Probably very few people. It's not terribly popular. Okay, what the crowd system does is allows you to do web browsing anonymously by joining what they call a crowd. And what happens is you run a local web proxy that whenever you make a web request, it goes to that proxy. And that proxy either randomly does one of two things. It either submits the query to the server, or else it passes it off to some other member of the crowd. And when it receives the request, it will either randomly submit it to the server or pass it off to another member of the crowd, and so on. If everyone's on 28.8, yeah.
If anyone is on 28.8.
If anyone is on 28.8, because it'll go through them. That's true. So the idea is that the web server operator will get in his log that the connection came from some member of the crowd, but you can argue that it wasn't me, it was just some other random person. Right? The idea is to give plausible deniability. And it's serious. That's what it's for. It's not useful. There's no encryption going on. It's not useful against people snooping the network. The entire idea is to make the entry in the log have plausible deniability behind it. And in that respect, Freedom is doing a similar thing in that the entry in the web server log will just have the IP address of some ape. Although there it will be more obvious that it is not, in fact, someone sitting at the ape that's browsing. Just like today, I get tons of hits in my log from proxy1.aol.com. Right? It's pretty obvious it's not the guy that runs proxy1.aol.com browsing this from the console. You never know. Right? And that's the idea behind crowds. Right? And that's the idea behind crowds. Okay, so while this is up, how is this different from IPsec? IPsec again, I'm trying to click with this and it's not working. IPsec again is a solution to a different problem. This is basically what I talked about right at the beginning. IPsec doesn't attempt to hide the endpoints of the communication stream. When you're talking about IPsec in tunnel mode between two firewalls, it does manage to hide the which particular machine behind the firewall it is, but NAT does that just as well. So that's not what we're talking about here. Nor does it attempt to hide the existence of a communication stream. And these two things are exactly what the pseudonymous IP network is trying to do. Having said that, we do use a lot of the same internal kernel hackery. Right? A lot of the same tricks that are used to grab your IP packets and encrypt them in IPsec are what we're using to grab your IPsec and grab your packets and encrypt them before handing them off to the traffic shaper. Because this is one big piece that IPsec is missing compared to Freedom, right? Because this isn't part of IPsec's threat model. They don't have to do that. Yeah.
Is your code open?
Not yet, but because it's still in development beta, but long term, yes. Oh, I knew someone would ask that. If anyone knows me, they know I use the good algorithms, right? We know not to make up algorithms ourselves. We have, for symmetric encryption, we have Blowfish, Triple Des, DesX. For asymmetric, we have Diffie-Hellman, Al-Gamal, DSS for signing. Just exactly the algorithms you would hope I would answer to this question with. And decent key sizes, no less 40 or 56 garbage. We're in Canada, damn it. Yeah.
A quick question, jumping back to the voice over IP and the latency issue.
Sure.
Has there been any investigation into using, perhaps putting more hardware acceleration into the encryption and decryption process along the way to move that latency as low as possible?
Yeah, so definitely once we have the system up and out there, we'll be trying to get these latencies as low as possible using things like the NCypher and Fast boards. Mm-hmm. That's a promising one. There are a number of other companies that make similar stuff. It turns out the encryption really isn't the bottleneck. Processor speeds are much, much faster now than network speeds for the most part.
Than WAN speeds.
than WAN speed. Yeah, definitely. But that's where most of these packets are going anyway. So we'll have to look very carefully at where the latency is coming from. If it's just coming from network latency, not a lot we can do about that, except for laying our own fiber everywhere, which is much longer term. Yeah.
Why did you not use IPsec from 8 to 8?
Oh, for the same reason. IPsec doesn't...
No, but from 8 to 8, you already know, you told us, a UDP packet stream versus IPsec packet stream is the equivalent.
No, that UDP packet stream still has to be link and packet padded, right? Which IPsec won't give you.
Yes. You can do both.
Link padding. IPsec won't randomly generate packets at fixed intervals and send them, as far as I know.
No, it doesn't also preclude you from doing that.
You can still do that.
You can still do that. Yeah, from user space.
But you can still, if you had an IPsec implementation that was open to you, I'm just... I understand why you do it again in UDP, UDP encapsulation, rather than just doing it as
IPsec. So there the answer was an IPsec implementation was not available to us at the time.
Okay.
You're right, it's pretty much equivalent that to do the link padding between apes as encrypted UDP or as IPsec and IP.
You're doing Diffie-Hellman between apes. Generate keys.
Diffie-Hellman, authenticated Diffie-Hellman between apes to generate keys.
But you're not using keys to do that.
Not using those particular
things at all. Yeah.
But those are, all these pieces are, of course, modular, and once IPsec gets widely out there, we'd be more than happy to drop in a better standard. Yeah?
What is this going to do to network traffic in general? Sounds like you've got packets going all over the place before they finally get to the end of the pipe and then go to their destination. And
they all own JDS Vitel stock.
Yeah, so there are obviously issues involving the internal routing of traffic. And it's in fact much more complicated than you even expect now. The short answer is, that's why I'm getting a PhD out of this.
How does the end ape that sends it out in the clear to the guy in there, how does he, what does he use so that he knows the returning packets?
That's the third part. I'll get to that later.
Oh, okay.
I erased it.
Do you always have the last eight? Is that always the same?
No.
Changes between, but let's say that, I'm some server and I don't want anybody coming in that I don't know. I figure out who all your apes are and I say you're not.
That's okay. I mean, servers can block traffic from AOL as well. I mean, there's nothing stopping servers from saying, I refuse to give service to anyone running Linux. But the way you combat that is where we invoke our marketing arm. And they say, these services are against personal privacy and freedom. And just have people wank at them. Okay, on we go. So what have I talked about? I've talked about the traffic shaper for inside the network. Now we'll talk about how packets get into the wormhole in the first place. I changed the order of my slides. Okay. So, what's that?
It involves getting involved with the board.
Okay. So we have all the programs on your Linux client. They're trying your Netscape or your whatever it is on there that's sending out data, send mail, anything that wants to try to send out IP packets. We'd prefer if those packets were just handed off to some other process or some particular entity that could encrypt them before sending them out. Unfortunately, we can't go in and hack every single program to do that. So we do basically the same tricks that IPsec does, which is we tell the kernel to do it for us. right? All IP packets already go through this kernel path when they're about to go out the network. And we just grab them there using the IP firewalling hooks. So we have this shim device, dev zk shim. And this shim device, when you open it, it's a lot like opening a sock packet socket. How many of you are familiar with sock packet sockets in Linux? Basically the IPsec guy. So the idea is that you have this device that when you open it and you read from it, you get packets. You get network packets on the read. So what a sock packet socket does is allows you to get all Ethernet traffic, say, going across your Ether cable. And that's how TCP dump works, for example. Right, it opens the sock packet socket and just reads all the Ether packets going across your cable and just prints them out in a nicely formatted way. First approximation. Yep.
Does the sock packet socket implicitly invoke promiscuous mode?
No, you have to do that yourself.
Okay.
No, but you also do get packets sent. TCP dump does show you packets that you sent as well. In most cases.
Yes. It turns out that's annoyingly not all. Yeah. And not in, yeah. So what we have is exactly to fill in that hole. We have the ZK shim that acts almost exactly like opening a sock packet socket, only it intercepts all packets going out, and it actually intercepts them. It's not like sock packet even would once this is finished, which would just give you a copy of all packets that have gone out on the wire. This gives them to you instead of putting them out on the wire. Okay, so now you get to do whatever you want with them and write them yourself. And you can put in simple filters, so you can say, only give me packets to these ports or these protocols or whatever. That's a useful thing to do. Okay, so by popular demand, I actually put some code in here. Okay, and this is just how you use the ZK shim. It's pretty straightforward. You just open the device and you get a file handle back. This next few lines is an example of how to insert a filter. So this filter says only give me packets destined for UDP port number 7. Okay, the echo port. It's unclear exactly why you'd want to do that, but we can fake out remote echoes. Yeah.
Find that if you're talking to yourself.
And then you call the ioctl. I don't know how many of you were at the first talk today, the tutorial about hacking or programming the kernel. So these are one of these ioctls that you can do all sorts of funny things with, though apparently they're really slow. But that's okay, because you just do it at the beginning. And then to read data, you just do a pull or a select or your favorite thing in this file descriptor to figure out when there's data available, and data becomes available. And when you read it, you have your data. Yep.
So what happens to the packets that don't match the filter?
They just go out. Packets that don't match the filter just go out the network as they were intended. And packets that do match are prevented from going out and given to you via this mechanism. Right. Okay, so now let's talk a little more about that shim. So this is what the local client will use to... Whoa. To inject packets into the wormhole. And what's important to note is that this anonymous IP cloud that has the wormhole as its entrance, the wormhole is on the local machine. It's not the case that it would, in fact, be much, much easier to do this, but it decreases security. If we just said, just send all your packets to us as a proxy, and then we'll stick them in the system and all this, then we'd have to give you very little extra software. You just manually configure your routing tables or something to send packets to us, or maybe do an IP tunnel, which would be the simplest thing. But then all your packets from you to The first one would be in the clear and wouldn't be link padded and wouldn't be packet padded and all of that. Yeah?
How simple would it be if you had, say you had an ape on your local network and you trusted your local network with enough? Is the implementation of it on the ape such that you couldn't simply use the ape as a proxy?
Not right now. You can't do that now, but that obviously is a useful thing that hopefully will be done later. Guys?
Yeah.
Our implementing team is back there.
What if you just use Masquerade and just set that as your gateway and just use Masquerade to get you out onto the ape network? That might
just work because of the way, because of the fact that it's in the firewalling code. Maybe.
Depends on who looks after the firewall.
So, like, if I have the firewall box as a gateway and it's doing masquerading, packets come in on the internal network from this host. It will, on its way out, it will go through the shim code and get apified.
So you're saying that the firewall becomes an ape.
The firewall becomes
the start of a wormhole,
but everyone behind it automatically get their stuff filtered through it.
And everyone behind it can read that traffic.
Everyone behind it can read the traffic, but that's okay, because I'm assuming you're on a trusted internal network. That might just work. Should just try hooking machines up in that way and see. Anything else about the shim? Let's see if I can... Can't talk a little more about the shim. There's not much more to say. The shim's actually a very simple piece of code. As I said, it hooks into the IP firewalling bits of the Linux kernel and just grabs your packets on the way out.
Who decides the collection of apes you're getting forwarded through?
The client does. So
when you're first connecting to the first ape, you pick an ape and then...
You set up a secure connection with it. Remember right near the beginning I said you set up connections between the client and 1, the client and 2, the client and 3. So the client gets to pick who 1, 2, and 3 are. Basically, the client sets up a secure connection between the client and 1. Then the client sends a packet down that connection telling 1, okay, now connect to 2. And he picks some value of 2.
So the topology of possible apes, you get dynamically configured with that? Do you have to have a knowledge of all the apes available?
You need to have you need to have a knowledge of all the apes available. It actually gives you better security that way, slightly poorer performance, and we're looking at how we want to trade off the performance security and if we want to give that knob to the user. Right, because there's a limited amount we want to let the user turn down his security in order to add to his performance, and we have to decide. This is purely a social issue, not a technical issue, where we want to put that knob.
If you set up the link initially, since there's no data we can send yet, and if you will only do padding at that point, you might as well send them the list of all the apes that you have.
Exactly. So it turns out that's not the hard issue. It's pretty easy to get the list of all the apes. The hard issue, if you know stuff about routing, is source routing in a large network is difficult. Right? And effectively what you're doing is all packets are being source routed now. And that's just hard. So we have to decide how much we want to trade off doing dynamic route adjustment in the middle of the network via complete source routing. Yeah?
Is there any way to prevent the user from sending packets to a host and telling him to send it to another host and then back, like flooding the network?
So denial of service attacks are not something we can even reasonably defend against. We can have each ape put bandwidth limiting on any given connection, but nothing's to stop all the script kiddies in the world from targeting one machine and bringing it down. Right. So there's a limited amount you can do against denial of service attacks.
Still have a maximum hop count, right?
Still have a maximum hop count, yeah. So you can't go forever around the network. But you can use up resources larger than we'd like you to.
The apes don't necessarily talk directly together, right? Like, when you go from ape to ape, it could be going through...
Oh, the internet. Yeah. It'll go through the internet in order to do that. So apes aren't... Although it would be nice if we could physically hook up the apes together that, again, involves a lot of infrastructure cost. In fact, a lot of this system, the whole complexity of this system, is because of that observation I made earlier. I'm going to pretend the NIMITY slider is still here. That the internet, when you make an IP connection, basically inherently is set up here somewhere near true name. IP address is really close to true name. And we're trying to build a system on top of that that has the NIMITY slider lower. And as I said, that's really hard. Right? It's like trying to make an anonymous credit card transaction. So this is the reason of the whole complexity of the system. If we could scrap the internet, or not use the internet, but deploy our own network that didn't have this property of starting off up here, if we could use other technologies, it turns out ATM networks are very amenable to this sort of thing. And if we are not stuck with using what's out there now to build on top of, we could build a network that had inherently a much lower value on the NIMITY slider. Then if we wanted, we could run IP over that because we can always move it up, or we could run this protocol or both. Right? So, but this involves, I mean, like laying cable, right?
So it would probably be simpler if all the apes were connected by ATM and just getting between an end user.
Yes,
and an
so if all the apes were directly connected by ATM, that would solve a lot of this, would solve a lot of problems.
No, I thought ATM was wide enough and available that you could get apes connected that way, just not end users.
It's possible, and that's probably the first step to migrate to instead of laying your own fiber. But still, it's much better to be able to deploy these things on any arbitrary host out there than require you're at a NAP on an ATM fiber somewhere.
It's not. The problem is there's an advantage to being on the internet, which is versus ATM, which is that the caught on ATM, you tend to pay quite directly by the byte and by the peak committed rate. On the other hand, you're producing data, the link padding, continuously anyway.
Really, that's right.
So you may really want to buy a committed bit rate connection because it's very useful that way. But I don't think there's a problem with most of your boxes are going to have to be relocated somewhere close to something that has fiber, or at least several T1s anyway.
Right,
so,
yeah.
I mean, you're going to have to be located near those centers.
So the question is it near it, or is the box directly connected to it?
Yeah.
And the difference is whether there is a place for an eavesdropper to watch for the existence of packets between the ATM link and the box.
Yes, Ma Bell, run by the government.
Right. So
knows exactly every single one of your links, versus on the internet, there's at least a dozen internet service providers that you have to subpoena.
Right. So.
And they get their local loops with that.
All of their other traffic on it as well. So you're getting the advantage of all of them link padding the traffic.
Yeah, you're using. The goal of any of these systems, the crowd slogan is anonymity loves company. Right. As I said right at the beginning, your true name is something that picks you out of a crowd. If you can make that crowd really big, it's always going to be a win for anonymity. If the crowd is three people... yeah.
A slight off of technology. You deploy this, Spamford becomes your biggest customer. You started at the beginning of somebody saying, well, what if you found out where all these are and you just put them in your spam filters? Well, I can see me going home and figuring that out right now.
Okay.
That's more of my issue than being able to be anonymous. I can see the benefits of being anonymous for me, but the threat.
Okay, so I'm
going to
make you really happy. We totally stop spam.
Sorry?
Okay, I'm going to make a broad claim that we totally stop spam. Obviously,
I mean, without nuclear missiles, how are you going
to
do that?
So it turns out you can't use this system to send spam.
Okay.
Because all of the mail gets anonymized through our system, and we can just simply limit you to 500 email messages a day, right? No spammer can possibly exist sending 500 email messages a day.
But you already said that you can have multiple pseudonyms.
You can have multiple pseudonyms, but that costs money.
5 million individual
it's the pseudonyms
people.
That cost money.
We receive 3,000 emails a day.
You're assuming you're the only one doing it.
Well, 3,300.
If there's many other companies that set this up in a larger and larger network,
well,
then there's...
It's still, we're talking very wrong order of magnitude here. Right? Spammers have to send tens to hundreds of thousands of email messages an hour. Right? In order to be justifiable for them, it turns out. So if you limit them to dozens or hundreds of email messages a day, and any other company which does something like this that doesn't have those limits obviously will become known as a spammer haven, right? And on the other side of the coin, we can also help you...
How would they become known as a spammer haven?
Well, lots of people would start getting lots of spam from...
Dial-ups.
These systems, right?
Then the anonymity is lost at some point, right?
No, it's clear that the person you receive mail from is a user of this system. You just don't know which.
A user of the freedom system.
Okay. Right.
So how do you charge people money if they have anonymity? You're not the
kind of okay. Well, it's a really good question. That's not what I intended to talk about, but fine. Right. There's a maxim in computer science that says all problems can be solved with an additional level of indirection. So what we do basically is this. You don't pay for pseudonyms directly. You come and you buy somehow a serial number. There are a number of ways you could do this. The best ways are go to a store and pay for one with cash. The serial number will be on a little slip of paper inside the box. Other good ways involve somehow getting a money order or cash to mailing it to head office. And then doing some little web tricks to receive your serial number. It turns out you can even buy them over the web with a credit card. Now you think, well, wait a minute. So what happens is that serial number, again, does not entitle you to a number of NIMs. It entitles you to a number of what we call tokens. And these tokens have the property that you can't tie who purchased them with them when they're redeemed. Okay? And
how do I know that?
How do you know that? And the answer, unfortunately, there's a different short-term answer than the long-term answer. The long-term answer is because we'll be using anonymous eCash technology that has blinded signatures and all this fun math that you may or may not know about that guarantees that we have no way to determine which bought token corresponds to which redeemed token. The reason it's long-term different from short-term is because there are some niggly patent issues involved that we have to work out. So, no, not RSA, Sean. So, for the short term, the answer is we promise not to tie it, and you trust our auditors. So, well, we don't keep that information, right? So even if we get a subpoena, we just don't have it. The name of the company is Zero Knowledge for the reason that we have no knowledge of who is behind what name. We don't want to know. We don't want to have to deal with people coming to us with subpoenas. Hotmail, for example, had this exact problem. It used to be Hotmail was getting subpoena, trying to determine what IP address belonged to a particular mail that was sent out. They finally said, I'm tired of this. and they just put that information in the header of every outgoing email message. Right? So they no longer, if you can arrange it that your company has no more information than is publicly available, you just stop the flow of subpoenas. And you, or if someone comes with one, you just say, go look it up on the web for yourself. Right? We have this database, query it. Yeah.
In a similar token, and somebody brought up subpoenas, if Zero Knowledge is the, say, administrator of the billing software and such like that, the data couldn't be extracted with the subpoena or such, but what if you were in receipt of a cease and desist order, stop the operation of this system? Wouldn't that be a single point of failure?
Okay, so you have to be very careful about single points of failure. The only real single point of failure would be for the CA. So it would be no new NIMS would be created. Mm-hmm. But nothing would stop existing NIMS from working because Zero Knowledge does not operate these apes. These apes are operated by third parties, ISPs and stuff like that, privacy groups around the world. So a cease and desist order to us wouldn't hurt that at all. There are other pieces of the network that currently Zero Knowledge operates the only one of, but we'll definitely diversify that. There's no good reason for that. The only thing that Zero Knowledge has to operate is the billing system, basically. And that's, I mean, technically that's only for business reasons, right? In theory, we could allow anyone to take money and create NIMS, but... it's a good question. What you do is you subscribe to one of these systems, to one of these credit card taking services that vets the credit card numbers.
Now they know who I am.
Well, they but the credit card number side, we assume the credit card is not anonymous, right?
I thought the point was to not allow the knowledge that I was making any kind of communication with somebody else, and if they know that I bought one of your names.
No. So it's, it will always be clear in the system that you are a Freedom user, right? It will be clear that you're using Freedom to communicate,
but we don't know
with who.
But you don't have to. You could buy the subscription and never use it. You just have traffic go back and forth with just adding.
But there would be traffic from your workstation.
There'll be traffic from your workstation.
Yeah, but it could be.
Okay.
But it could be not,
fine. I'll make the converse statement, which is more true. It is clear that it is not the case that you are not a Freedom user. Something like that. No, sorry. It is not...
Half an hour more, you can go in marketing.
It could be quite clearly established that you are not using Freedom.
Yeah. Yes.
But the opposite is not
that
true.
Was that this deniability thing again?
No. This is, I mean, we'd love it to be the case that you couldn't even tell that you were using Freedom. But that's like the third level of, so the first level was making sure your communications, the contents are secure, then the fact of the communication is secure, then the entire fact that you're communicating at all, and that level is called steganography, if you're familiar, if you're not familiar with that. And, I don't know of a good technique to stego your packets over a net connection right now without it being totally obvious that you're doing it. Right? Most people don't upload GIFs a lot.
Have all the apes be located in Art Museum displaying random images off the web and exchange them with each other?
So you have to be the server.
And a browser. You have to be a porn site and a porn consumer.
So if we just mandate that everyone on the net send and receive lots of images all the time.
You just mandate that everyone just signs up.
Well, there you go. That would, I mean, there you have exactly the crowds phenomenon, right? That if everyone is running Freedom, then it gives you no information.
Bone, a Rideau River cam or something like that.
So MBone is actually an interesting issue. There are lots of ways that the Freedom Network can benefit from multicast that I probably won't go into now. Yeah.
How does the Q
key setup work from the client to the, always to the first eight, it's easy, but to the second and third and fourth, does it go through the first eight?
Yes.
So in fact, it builds sort of a series of tunnels.
It's kind of like a telescope,
yeah,
that when you pull it out,
okay,
there's a bunch of nested encryption layers.
So how many levels deep of encryption are you? Like, it doesn't decrypt it and then recrypt it.
No, that's correct. So the client takes the IP packet. So after it's set up this telescope, the client takes the IP packet, encrypts it five times, and drops it into the wormhole. The first ape will strip off the outer layer, pass it on. The next ape will strip off the outer layer, pass it on. And at the end, the last guy will strip it off, notice, oh, I have a clear text packet, and send it where it belongs.
Do you picture bananas being peeled when you talk to the ape?
Yep.
Do you also have, as you strip off layers, you have probably some control? That
yeah, for sure.
So you replace it with more padding.
Right. And it turns out decrypting does not change the size of the packet.
Yes.
Because of what we're doing.
Are you just re-encrypting the headers of each layer, or is the entire content getting encrypted five times?
Yes, the entire content is being encrypted five times. That way the intermediate apes can't correlate packets going through the system. Yeah. Luckily, bulk encryption is cheap. Right. Processors are studly.
What happens if one ape in the middle goes down?
Okay, if an ape in the middle goes down, what will happen is the client will notice, I've stopped getting packets, and ideally would just automatically renegotiate a route. Right now, I think the effect is it just tells the user, and has the user click renegotiate route.
And next question: when you are getting back the response, that each ape must keep an information about from which address to which next ape to route.
Correct. If you're familiar with ATM, it's very much the same thing. It's like virtual circuit dynamics.
Actually, I'm not familiar with ATM at all, but I'm a little bit worried about the length of the session and the amount of the entries in the session.
Right. So, again, it's just like ATM, where those two things are what you have to trade off.
Okay.
Right? So you don't end up with these absolutely huge virtual circuit lists. It's source routed, so that was the thing. Because of the way the encryption works, the client chooses for you. The client says, I'm going to set up a wormhole now between me and this mate in South Africa, and it's going to go through this one, and this one, and this one, and that one.
So you have to pad at each level to make up for the addresses.
Short answer, yes. Long answer, yes.
now, is if the packet is not re-encrypted from one ape to another, it's just removed layers?
It's decrypt. When it's going out,
yeah,
it's decrypted.
Only.
And when it's coming back, it's encrypted.
As well.
So
I'm trying to figure out how the eavesdropper can determine that, in fact, which part is padding. Maybe a length in there. I guess I can see how to do it.
Yeah. No, it's
so pretty the packet does change size as it's going from start to finish.
No. All packets in the cloud are exactly the same size.
Yeah. So you actually couldn't do it with IPsec.
You actually couldn't.
Couldn't, because if you could not add the padding. In IPsec, the padding has to be added before you encrypt.
Right.
Not after you encrypt.
So couldn't you put multiple ESPs?
You could layer multiple ESPs, that's true. But every time you took one off, you would then have to add some padding at the end to make the packet off bigger again. Right?
Right.
Now the problem is that the indication of how much padding is in an ESP packet is contained in the second last byte of the packet, which would be garbage.
Damn it! If I'd only been there while they were designing
this. Have another chance, because there may be a new ESP.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's Steve Belovin's one?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think it'll go
anywhere. No, I don't think so either.
Well, you can just have a transport-friendly ESP that's not very transport-friendly.
That's true. This would be not transport-friendly at all. Okay. Yeah.
My comment was regarding in cryptography, when you know a certain bit in your plain text, you're really reducing the level of security that you have on the encryption, right?
No, not really. Not if you have any good cryptography.
Okay.
If you have good cryptography, you can know all but one bit of the plain text, and you still only have a 50% chance of guessing which one that was. Like, no better than random.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do you do the return routing of the traffic?
Okay, so what happens is, as you... Oh.
Don't wait for that.
Right. That's an interesting point.
Okay. So what happens is the last ape, when it's about to send this IP packet out to the real server, it stuffs a dummy IP address as the source address of that packet. And that dummy IP address is basically, you know how virtual hosting works? It's basically a virtual host address for the same machine. So this is the exit ape. And I'll do that to indicate some other virtual IP address on the same subnet. Okay? And whereas the packets actually go out over the Ethernet, the source address, I'll just label this .11.12, the source address is .12. So this, of course, allows you to distinguish traffic coming from the ape itself. For example, when you're doing, when apes are connecting with each other for the purposes of doing a Diffie-Hellman negotiation, it connects to the actual ape, whereas packets going out from the wormhole are marked as coming from the virtual IP address, so that the web server here, the web server here will get the packets from .12. It will mark in its log a connection from .12, and more to the point, it will return its packets with destination .12. The exit ape is using, I think, almost exactly libpcap and sockpacket to read packets for .12. And it just takes them instead of running them through the TCP stack. The reason this is important is because, for example, the first packet, I'm hoping most of you know how TCP works, at least the handshake. So I'm not going to explain it too much. The first packet that comes out here, of course, if you imagine this is the client, I'm not going to try to draw a penguin. if you imagine this is the client, of course, the first packet it sent was the SYN, so this packet will be a TCP SYN. The most important thing was that this SYN was not a SYN to the first ape. You're not setting up a TCP connection with this guy. This SYN is then wrapped in this 5 layers of encryption. So this is just a garbage data packet to this guy. And only after it comes out here does it look like a TCP SYN. This guy gets it, thinks it just got a TCP connection request from this address .12, sets up its local TCP buffers and everything, and sends the SYNAC. Right? Now, the important thing is that the reason we had to do this .12 and not .11 is because if he sent this to .11, this exit ape's TCP stack would say, I just got a SYNAC from this guy, reset. Right? Because it didn't send a SYN. Its internal TCP state has no clue about this TCP connection. It's just been funneling garbage data back and forth.
Are you doing the virtual IP with promiscuous mode or with ARPs?
With ARPs.
Just ARP, but not with an IP alias.
ARPs, but not with... Actually,
proxy ARP,
I was just talking to Philippe about that today. It turns out I don't think we're doing IP aliasing now, but we should.
No, because then the TCP stack would take...
Would it automatically grab it? Can't we get it not to?
It's addressed for it. It's an alias. It's addressed to it.
Okay. Then we definitely have to not do that. No, you just need one spare IP address for every exit ape. Not for every client. All clients end up with .12.
Okay.
Right? And it's on the port number.
What
if you want to use a service
doing
that requires
that.
A dedicated port number?
Ah, so you're saying what if you want your client to be a server?
Yeah.
Or
basically are using some fixed protocol.
Or using, so any service that requires your client to send on a certain port number will break in the same way that NAT breaks. We're doing NAT, right? We're just doing NAT, and we're not only moving you in address space, we're moving you in physical space, right?
So you only support UDP and TCP?
Technically, no. We support arbitrary IP packets.
They don't have ports.
Good point. So that's why I said technically. any other protocol, we could send the packet with no problem. Other protocols would have to have their own way to figure out how you're replying to it. And if we discovered some other protocol we care to support, what's that?
Like H323.
Like H323, do you have a good reason for wanting that? Like directly on the wire as opposed to encapsulated?
No, I have people around that meeting, but not me.
Okay. There's a question?
There was a question.
All right, when it comes back.
No, bring us again. I have another question. On the way back, is it re-encapsulating everything? Like does
yes, yes.
Exit A,
okay, so let's just continue with this. So this SYNACK comes up to here where this guy is listening using the PCAP for packets destined to .12, which this TCP stack does not get a chance to get its hands on. So this exit ape gets this packet, uses the port number that it generated randomly, or next in sequence, or randomly would be better, here, which will be here, to figure out which virtual circuit it's part of. And in its virtual circuit table, it has a list of just like ATM, what the next host is, what the virtual circuit identifier for it is, and also an encryption key. And it will take this packet and encrypt it with that encryption key. Send it on to the next guy, which has the same thing. It will encrypt it with its encryption key, and so on. And when it gets all the way back to the client, this SYNACK will have been encrypted in 5 layers of encryption. The client decrypts it and stuffs it up its network stack.
Yeah. How does the next how does it know which circuit the packet's coming in?
Right.
Are supposed to go out on?
Because the link protocol has virtual circuit identifiers in it. So when this guy sends the packet...
Where are they assigned?
At route creation time.
Route creation time. Yeah. So then the previous ape has to be aware that a route is being created with the next ape.
Correct. Yes. Okay. Because that's when it sets up...
A series of 3 apes in a row that ape 1 and 3 would never be aware... that ape 1 and 3 would never be aware of each other.
That's correct.
Okay. But in fact, ape 2...
is aware of both 1 and 3.
Okay.
Correct. Because they share encryption keys.
My client's got all 5 keys.
Was there? Yes.
Recover it?
The protocols were spoken upon where they don't have port numbers or have other issues.
Would
the apes have, IP mask under Linux, has various little modules for certain protocols, be they...
FTP and real audio and stuff like that. So in order to get those to work, we'd have to do...
For ICMP.
Yeah, we'd have to do the very same tricks.
Okay, so you'd be planning on doing that.
Yeah, and in fact, that's done at the client side.
Oh, wait.
No, those masquerading tricks to change port numbers are done at the server side. Those are the application-level proxies that I mentioned was one of the other less interesting pieces. Yeah.
Now, does the final ape generate random web traffic? Like, will it go to a random host and...
So this is, as I mentioned earlier, a separate issue that's much harder.
There's only one user on this network on a quiet day. You can find out who...
Right, so anonymity loves company, right?
Yeah.
The goal is that never happens. But, yeah, it would be good to have cover application traffic as well. But it doesn't have to be, remember, this guy generating random traffic.
Anyone.
It can be anyone in the net. We can have our own clients just connecting into the network and actually just web browsing.
So you actually should have a search engine.
Yeah.
Wandering around the website. So it turns out spiders are really easy to spot because of the way they do traffic. So you'd have to write.
No, they just queue the alphabet, so it doesn't pitch for more than about 20 URLs at a time.
Yeah, so you just have to put that down to one and just have it. Yeah. Yeah.
So from client to server, is it a set of tunnels that you're setting, or all of the apes, they keep some sort of soft state?
I think both halves of those statements were true.
So each packet client is sending out, it's like if you're using five apes, then they're encapsulated five times?
That's correct.
So you're sticking in five headers on top.
No, it's not actual. It's not actually IP and IP encapsulation.
Okay.
Right, we're not sticking a new IP header, but it is logically encapsulated in that it's encrypted five times.
Encrypted five times. So all of the apes, they're keeping soft states about this virtual circuit, if you would call it.
Correct. Yep.
Then how scalable is this system?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Yeah, scalability is definitely something we're most interested in.
So, okay.
Is the case that you want to keep secret how much of the traffic between apes is real and how much is padding?
We'd like to keep secret which packets are real and which are padding.
But not the quantity.
The quantity... Against a passive eavesdropper, it turns out it doesn't matter. Against an active eavesdropper, it does matter.
I was thinking you might be able to detect that by trying to send packets through your system and seeing...
When they start dropping.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are all sorts of complicated cryptographic and other attacks against the system, and it's our goal to squish them. Yeah.
Your dummy traffic, how does it react to RED and other congestion control systems? Because it would seem that you're now increasing the likelihood that it's going to drop a garbage packet, which means the TCP will never learn to throttle itself.
Yeah, so this is a problem. It's mainly a problem if we're sending these packets over links that don't belong to us. But of course, that's most of the time. right?
Yeah.
So, yes, this is a problem. That because we're sending lots more traffic now, although most of it's dummy, we would prefer if it were the case that in RED or any other packet drop system, you'd only drop the dummy packets. But of course, that implies that someone in the middle can tell which packets are dummy and which aren't.
Some weighted reds will much prefer to drop UDP traffic because it doesn't react very well to...
it's true.
That those are the people that are being the
so
faster.
That kind of system actually is good for our purposes. If we can even tell you we prefer that you drop freedom traffic than any other traffic,
right. Then
we can just turn on full blast and just blast things, and just allow you to drop all our traffic and not affect anyone else. Now, it still has the effect that our traffic will get dropped more often than it ought to, but that's the price we pay for the better security.
Well, what if someone wants to have some quality of service?
Over this? That would be a second PhD that'll leave. That'll leave as an exercise to the reader. Yeah, and back.
Client specifies the five ape path, and that is in the packet that they send to the first ape.
No.
No.
Oh. Well, yes, but it's nested. It's nested encrypted.
Got it.
Right. So the first ape never gets a chance to see that information. Yeah.
Where does it get the keys to actually do the encryption? Where does the client get the keys?
Oh, it's we have a public key infrastructure. And there's so much crypto going on in this client.
Doesn't that mean that if someone is sitting even in between two apes, that if a packet comes around, the only thing you have to do is try a bunch of keys until you get the ultimate packet back?
So it's public keys.
28K.
They're public keys. Right. Just because you know the public key doesn't mean you can...
You try a bunch of private keys, like, I don't know, two of the 128 different private keys and you can crack it.
No, but the client.
So it's more than that.
The client only has the public key.
Correct.
Of the apes, right?
Right.
So if I get a packet that has been encrypted 5 times, and I get a list of all the public keys, I should reiterate those.
Otherwise, how do I get my packet out?
No. So public keys aren't deterministic. If you encrypt the number 1 in person A's public key, and then do it again, you'll get different answers. And if you encrypt the number 0, you'll get different answers. And one of the properties of public key cryptography is that you can't differentiate an encryption of a 1 from an encryption of a 0. Even if you know this encryption is only one of 2 things, you still can't tell which one it is, even if you know what public key it was encrypted under and that it was one of 2 different messages.
Then how does the client get his data packet?
He has the private key.
Using the private key, you can decrypt it.
Who's private key?
So no, with the client... So the...
Okay.
So now we're going to do a quick lesson in crypto. Yes. So the client sends...
He got the 5 layers back. What's he going to do with it now?
What?
He got the packet back with the 5 layers on it.
Right.
What does he do with it now?
Okay, so these 5 layers are using symmetric keys that were set up when the route was created. So this client, when he creates the route, he picks 5 servers. He also picks, it could be 5, it's, okay, just say 5 encryption, symmetric encryption keys, say triple DES keys. And what he does, he tells the first server, set up a route, the next hop is this guy, and your symmetric encryption key is this. And also send this encrypted rest of the route block to the next guy. And he can't read that. So he sends to this guy decrypts it with his private key, the public key system private key, and he sees a similar thing. The next hop is this guy, your symmetric key is this, and send this block of encrypted data onto him, and so on. When the route is done, what the state is that each hop knows the previous and the next guy and a shared symmetric key with the client. Right? That is only good for the lifetime of that route. When the data comes back, it's encrypted with these symmetric keys. So you have this packet that's now been encrypted in these 5 keys. And the client just, he also knows those 5 keys, and he just decrypts them in layers.
Yeah. How does the last 8 know that it's the last 8?
It's told. Yes, you just set a flag that says you have no next hop.
You're able to fairly easily determine an outsider can determine who's the last 8.
Yeah, it's the IP address that these things are coming from, that the actual data is coming from.
So considering the amount of encryption and whatnot going on the client, are you partnering with any encryption hardware assist company?
Not at the moment, but it turns out at the client it's pretty easy. At the client, almost all the encryption, in fact, there's very little private key operation going on here. There's a lot of public key operation, which is pretty cheap, and symmetric key operation, which is very cheap. Right? Bulk encryption is fairly cheap.
Test bench throughput?
Test bench throughput, right now, we were getting, if you aggregate it, it's about a megabyte. Megabyte per second.
Okay, on what type of processor?
What type of processor were you using?
What type of, whether it's an AIP or whether it's a client?
That was for an ape on a Linux box, but I don't know what it was. Do you guys know?
It's P2-233.
P2-233? There you go.
And for the client?
The client, we can easily saturate a 28.8 modem. So, or even... what's our max throughput on the client? Do we have a... Where's Marty? Marty's not here.
Marty's not here.
So...
our test was showing that.
What?
It's high.
It's high. High enough that we're saturating any conceivable link. These things are doing much less work than these things. Right. So if these guys can do a megabit, then... A megabyte, was it? Was it a megabit or a megabyte? 300 kilobits.
Pretty reasonable. pretty reasonable since you can talk to 10, 12, 14 megabits with that.
Right. Yeah.
But you're doing on average how many visits in a row?
Three to five, however. What? We're using DesX, yeah.
And
Blowfish.
But mostly what you're using. What, for these?
What's the default, you mean?
Yeah.
I have no idea. Oh, for benchmarking. I think that was triple DES, actually.
Default is Blowfish.
Oh, default is Blowfish? Default was Blowfish.
Because the numbers didn't sound right for triple DES.
They'd be close.
Well, our triple DES, you couldn't do it three times and get 1 megabit, I don't think.
Now, our DES on a P200 does 10 or 12 megabits per second. So, I don't know, 1.5 megabytes.
Yeah, so that's.
But then
that's
you're doing it 3D for something.
Yeah, the layers of the telescope add four.
Yeah, add
so
a little more.
It's in the right ballpark.
Yeah.
The processors are just ridiculously fast these days.
Yeah, so the bulk encryption isn't a problem. Yeah.
Last AIP resistant to the fact the client might itself be behind a NAT box?
So that's not the last. It turns out it's the first.
Yeah, that direction, yeah.
Right. It turns out...
Do you reply to the port that was...
Yeah, it turns out right now we don't, but that's a bug. It's a known bug. Yeah. So it looks like our time's up here. So thanks for coming. And come to the Zero Knowledge Party tonight.